Welcome to Side Streets, a podcast about the history and geography of London. I'm Alan Hertz, Professor Emeritus of Humanities at Hult International Business School. Despite my accent, I've been prowling London and learning about its past for over 40 years. Side Streets is a Black Lab media production, and my producer and editor is Wilhelm Schenk. In the next few episodes, we're going to explore my part of town, the borough of Richmond-upon-Thames. Nowadays, Richmond seems quite leafy, prosperous, maybe a bit dull, but I promise you it has a rich, varied, and strange history. In the next two episodes, we will visit a couple of wonderfully odd buildings within walking distance of my home and meet the two wonderfully odd people who created them. First, let's head north from Richmond Circus. Past the swimming pool that made a guest appearance last time, across the old Deer Park where the Tudors grazed their dinners, we get a glimpse of the old observatory from which George III tried to see the transit of Venus, maybe a subject for a future episode. We cross the Thames at Richmond Lock and glance at Gordon House just downstream. We'll take a closer look in a little while. Now let's walk down a tree-lined, curving suburban road past the campus of Ballet Rambert and turn right on St. Margaret's Road. We're beside a high brick wall. In it sits a plain, unmarked, locked door. We're about to open it with our imaginations, dear listeners, but if you want to see the Kilmore Mausoleum, the marvel on the other side in real life, you'll have to check with Habitats and Heritage, the local charity which cares for it. They have open days several times a year. In the meantime, you can find plenty of pictures on their website. Habitats and Heritage have recently published two booklets by the excellent local historian Andrew George. One is a biography of Black Jack Needham, the creator of the mausoleum. The other is a description of its design and construction. I'm deeply indebted to and grateful for both of them. Say a magic word or two, click your shoes three times, the doors open. There, surrounded by an elegant low iron balustrade, is an enormous granite tent which might have been magically transported here from the Nile Valley. As we will see, it hasn't traveled quite that far, but it is a lot more movable than it looks. The mausoleum is almost as tall as the interwar villas whose roofs you can see beyond the back walls. It is adorned with beautiful, elaborate carved friezes. It has false doors on three sides and a magnificent bronze door on the fourth. Push it. Despite its weight, it oozes open, and step inside. The interior space is illuminated by star-shaped golden skylights. You are between two coffins, decorated in leather, studded with complex patterns of upholstery nails. In front of you is a marble bas-relief of four figures. At its center is a beautiful woman lying on a chaise longue. A boy is weeping at her head. A bearded man is sitting at her feet, holding both her hands with a gentleness touchingly at odds with his obvious, brutal physical power. All are dressed like ancient Romans. Above them, an angel holding a cross points toward heaven. The woman is Priscilla Host. The boy is her son Charles, and the man is Black Jack Needham, 2nd Earl of Kilmurry, the person responsible for this strangely moving experience. Francis Jack Needham was born in 1787. He was known by his middle name because the eldest sons of this ancient and wealthy family are always called Francis. Why he was called Black Jack is less certain. Some sources say this was because of his swarthy complexion, but in surviving pictures, he is a rich, upper-class pink. The Needhams had huge estates in Northern Ireland and the Midlands. As an adult, Black Jack had an annual income equivalent to several million pounds today. The first Earl had a not particularly distinguished military career, and Black Jack followed his father into the army, serving with a similar lack of distinction. He married in 1814, having fathered his first illegitimate child a few years earlier, served as MP for Newry for a few years, and succeeded to the earldom on his father's death in 1832. So far, so typical. He could be a minor character in one of the Silver Fork novels of the time. But his life was unusual in one respect. His father's will placed the family property in a trust, so Black Jack had no say in its management. This unusual and drastic action was undoubtedly prudent. Jack had already run up enormous debts and would spend his way through life with magnificent extravagance. But it also left him without roots. He collected the income from his estates, but rarely seems to have thought of them as home or even as a responsibility. In 1814, Jack married Jane Gunn, a woman from an equally eminent Anglo-Irish family. They had four children in 5 years, but the marriage was a very public failure. Jack was unashamedly, enthusiastically adulterous. According to the gossip columns of the time, he gave one mistress a baby elephant. In 1835, he and Jane separated formally. I should say that Jack was very generous to wives as well as mistresses. Jane got to keep all the property she brought to the marriage and also received an annuity of £2,000, the equivalent of several hundred thousand today. Unburdened of family as well as estates, Jack continued his career of careless extravagance, devoting much of his time and resources to sport. He famously rode, with five servants, from Oxford to Westminster in 18 hours, bribing lockkeepers all the way down the Thames to make it possible. He equally famously shot 30 brace of partridges, that's 60 birds, in a day and retrieved them himself without the aid of servants or dogs. He also began to collect property, buying hotels in Canada and Switzerland. He seems to have been traveling constantly. Sometime in 1842, when Jack was in his mid-50s, his life changed. He met Lady Harriet Hoste, widow of the Napoleonic naval hero Sir William Hoste, and her children, notably the 19-year-old Priscilla. By early 1843, the Hostes were traveling with Jack, apparently as his guests, and in October, Jack and Priscilla, who was not yet legally an adult, eloped. If Priscilla had been an ordinary girl, this would have been a minor scandal, one of many in Jack's life. But Lady Harriet was a Walpole, sister to the Earl of Orford, so this was real news, and the early Victorian equivalent of Interpol went into action. In April of 1844, the fugitive couple were tracked down in Geneva. Priscilla was taken by police to Paris, where she was placed in a private hospital. She was 5 months pregnant. A spectacularly public custody battle ensued. Priscilla did not want to return to her mother, whom she accused of abuse. In this, she was supported by some, but not all, of her siblings. Jack published correspondence which seemed to show that Lady Harriet had sold him access to her daughter for a combination of money and sexual services. The case dragged on in the French courts and English newspapers until it ceased to matter. On Priscilla's 21st birthday, when she legally became an adult and could do as she liked, Jack arrived at the private hospital and took her away. Charles, the weeping boy in the mausoleum, was born 3 weeks later. They spent the rest of Priscilla's life, 11 short years, in Twickenham. We don't know much about what she did here, although several paintings and drawings of riverside scenes survive, but Jack seems to have been very busy indeed. He bought a string of Thames riverside villas. Radnor House, Cross Deep House, Orleans House, Gordon House, in what seems like a substitute for the estate management his father had denied him, he renovated each of them, sharing design responsibilities with his architects and physical labor with his construction crews. He socialized with his men as well, taking them to Christmas pantomimes and rowing with them on the river. The climax of this feverish activity was the purchase of St. Margaret's House in 1851. He demolished it, designed a replacement with the distinguished architect Louis Vuillaume, built it at the cost of a couple of million pounds in today's money, completing it by the summer of 1852. Jack built this huge, porticoed, pedimented mansion as a dream home for his new family, but they never lived there. By the time it was finished, Priscilla was disabled by the heart disease that would kill her, and even before her death, Jack began his weirdest construction project. He'd been impressed by the Egyptian court at the Great Exhibition of 1851, and he decided that Priscilla's memorial should be in an Egyptian style and on a scale worthy of the Valley of the Kings. He purchased a plot in Brompton Cemetery intended for 24 graves. As the cemetery was government property, Jack had to get special permission from the Home Secretary and the Chancellor of the Exchequer to build something as large as he envisioned. Once that was obtained, architects, stonemasons, sculptors, consultant Egyptologists all set to work. The mausoleum may have been designed to look ancient Egyptian, but it was built with the most modern technology. The granite came from two quarries and was cut, carved, and polished by Alexander MacDonald's works in Aberdeen. MacDonald had invented a steam-powered saw to cut up to 18 granite slabs at a time, but it did so at the incredible pace of 2/3 of an inch, less than 2 centimeters, per day. Carving was done by hand, equally slowly. The stone was so hard that chisels and axes had to be sharpened several times a day. Polishing was also done by hand, in 3 stages, with beach sand, then emery, the stuff on nail files, then leather. Each of the panels that form the walls of the mausoleum would have taken months to produce. The interior is interesting, too. The marble sculpture I described earlier was created by Lawrence MacDonald, a Scottish sculptor working in Rome. Jack had modeled for him in happier times, but we don't know if he had ever seen Priscilla or Charles, so we don't know how accurate those likenesses are. Jack designed the twin coffins, one for her, one eventually for him. He even forged the coffin nails and created the elaborate designs on their surface himself. Andrew George estimates the cost of the stone alone at 5,000 to 6,000 pounds, perhaps £1 million today. To that, we must add the cost of the cemetery plot, the architect's fees, transport from Aberdeen, construction, and God knows what else. We don't know what Priscilla, confined to her bed in their Grosvenor Square townhouse, thought about all this. She died in October 1854, and her body was placed in the newly completed mausoleum in November 1855. After Priscilla's death, Jack was restless. He moved in 1856, again in 1862, and this time he took the mausoleum with him. It was dismantled and transported to the grounds of his new house in Surrey, Woburn Park. Jack's commitment to Priscilla was not quite total, however. Within a few months of the death of his wife Jane, remember her? In 1867, he married again, to a woman over half a century younger than he was. He and Martha moved back to Twickenham, and the mausoleum and Priscilla came with them, this time to their current location in what were then the grounds of Gordon House. A public right-of-way, now Kilmorey Road, crossed the land separating the mausoleum from the house, and Jack had a tunnel dug underneath it. He apparently used to wrap himself in a shroud, lie in his coffin, and be wheeled by servants through the tunnel to the tomb, where he would spend the night with his soulmate. What his wife, or the servants, made of that is not recorded. The house became a school after his death, and ex-students fondly remember being pushed through the tunnel by their classmates. Jack was a celebrity all his life, not for any particular achievements, but for his eccentric personal habits and his utter fearlessness in the face of the press and the law. He loved animals and kept a menagerie of snakes, monkeys, and other beasts, which, like the mausoleum, traveled with him when he moved. He had yet another very public dispute with the post office when one of his snakes escaped from its packaging in a sorting office. His habits of dress and diet were as unconventional as his love life. He was compulsively hospitable, but declined to dress for dinner, and would entertain guests tieless, in an open-necked shirt, red trousers, and a blue coat with brass buttons. He had a set of scales in his dining room and weighed all his food before consuming it, but his guests could apparently eat and drink to their heart's content. Maybe the diet worked, since Jack lived to be 93, dying in 1880. He was buried in a rat fur dressing gown, which he had kept specially for the occasion. His coffin was carried from Gordon House through the tunnel for the last time, and he was placed in the mausoleum beside his beloved Priscilla. All of Jack's Twickenham houses are either gone or have been completely rebuilt. His only local legacy is the mausoleum. But I can think of few structures that reveal the personality of their maker more clearly and touchingly. It's hard to approve of this man. He was rootless, extravagant, and irresponsible. But his devotion to Priscilla seems to have been as constant as the rest of his life was inconstant, and the tons of apparently immovable granite which wandered with him around England are a perfect representation of the contradictions in his character. Hard to approve of, but easy to love. I'm delighted to have him as a neighbor. Well, that's enough for now. Thanks for listening. It may surprise you to hear that my borough is home to two stone tents. You can find out about the other one in our latest alleyway, which will be posted soon. Next time, we will visit another local landmark, the Marianne North Gallery, the expression in architecture and oil paint of another complex, fascinating, uncompromising personality. This episode was researched, written, and presented by me, Alan Hertz. Side Streets is a Black Lab Media production, and my producer and editor is Wilhelm Schenk.